This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. Hello, this is Dr. Jonathan Abel. I'm here with Dr. Bill Nance.
Hello.
And Dr. Mark Hall. Dr. Hall is both a history professor here and a lawyer. So we're going to talk about a very important part of military history that is often not properly addressed, particularly in operational accounts, and that's international law. So, Dr. Hall, we've already recorded a podcast looking at kind of the development of the concepts of international law through about 1945. So could you briefly summarize kind of your take on the pre-Nuremberg concepts and practice of international law?
It's simple in one sense, in that the prior to the end of the First World War, there was essentially nothing. And then briefly during the Versailles Treaty, there was one of the provisions that said that there could be international tribunals to try Germans. Mm-hmm. That didn't coalesce for a variety of reasons, one of which is the American who was in charge of the committee to do that essentially sabotaged it. The result was we forced the Germans in what we call the Leipzig trials to try their own people. And Leipzig gets kind of a bad stick, but I think that there's some effort, at least among the German judiciary, to actually try to do a good job. There were some problems with the case, certainly, and that's probably another podcast for another day. But between Leipzig and 1945, there is essentially nothing. This is when the discussions start to take place to the formation of the Nuremberg trials and what the International Military Tribunal and then the Nuremberg Military Tribunals that occur, the 12 cases afterward. Mm-hmm.
So we have two models kind of post or immediate post-World War II international law and tribunals. One of them is Nuremberg, which is kind of the standard bearer for prosecution of war crimes. But there's also the Tokyo trials, which take place in Japan, ostensibly for the same reasons, but with some different outcomes. So what is the difference between the two?
There are a lot of similarities in the sense that you have a multinational jury. In the case of Nuremberg, you have four of the occupying powers, those most concerned with Europe. I forget off the top of my head how many in the Far East, but many. That made up the judges in the case and made up the prosecutors and defense attorneys. One of the things with Nuremberg as well as with Tokyo was in the case of the Tokyo, you have what were called the A and B and C offenders. The A offenders were people who were involved in crimes against peace. None of the defendants were on trial at Tokyo that were not accused of being people who were not accused of being an A-list offender.
So these are high-level policy military folks?
Military and political, both. Some convicted, some not. In the case of Nuremberg, you have there are four counts in the indictment, crimes against peace, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and conspiracy. And it's a mixed bag. So some of the people there are accused of all. Some of the people are there accused of one. Some of them are, two and three of the counts. Which presents some evidentiary and some fairness issues with both Tokyo and with Nuremberg, and the idea that a defendant who is not accused of a particular crime is still sitting in the dock while evidence is presented against somebody else who is.
Mm-hmm. So one of the questions that kind of comes up here with Nuremberg, and actually with all international laws, for something to be a crime, there must obviously be a law that covers this. And There, in 1945, there seems to be almost a split, because up until this point, when we were talking with Dr. Snyder earlier, a lot of this seems to be very much national law. I'm going to prosecute Americans under American law. I'm going to prosecute Germans under German law, etc. But as a, for instance, I don't know of any American law in the books of crimes against humanity, as a for instance. So where does this shift in legal thinking coming from, where now people from an outside legal system are now going to come in and try and prosecute someone from another country with another legal system? How does this idea come about?
Well, in that dispute is part of what sank the attempt after the end of the First World War to put Germans on trial, because if you have the issues of whose law do you apply, what law do you apply, what are the jurisdiction issues? And in the case of Nuremberg, it is a very much a novel proceeding. They relied on this idea of customary international law, which is not statutory law at all. I mean, there was no place, there was no criminal code, there was no enforcement mechanism. These were just things that countries were generally expected to do, even though there weren't criminal sanctions if they failed to obey them.
So let me ask you a dumb, non-legal expert question, which I'll probably do several times in this episode. What's the difference between common law and recorded law or civil law or however it's phrased, where common law is kind of this generalized, unwritten set of principles, and then you have the more codified, like, legal codes?
Well, in the case of common law, so it's generally an Anglo-American concept. And the idea is, of course, that there are laws on the books, but it shifts the responsibility for interpreting and, if necessary, changing those laws to the judiciary. In the case of the United States, of course, there's a crime against murder in every jurisdiction, federal and military. But what that means in practice and applied to an individual case are going to be left to the judges and to the written decisions that the appellate system mm-hmm. or the Supreme Court makes. In the United States, the Supreme Court is, whatever they say, is the final word on the issue, unless it's revisited. In the case of civil law, which most European countries follow, besides the United Kingdom, it's exactly that. So in the German system, in the 1920s, 1930s, and earlier, they're relying on a legal theory called positivism. The idea there is the judge's role is not to interpret the law like you would in a common law jurisdiction. Your job is merely to apply the law. If there is a necessary change, that's going to have to be done through the national legislature.
So in the case of the post-World War II settlements, both in Europe and Asia, we have an Anglo-American tradition that maybe is more interpretive. We have, as you mentioned, this positivist continental tradition that is maybe more literalist. And then, of course, you get into issues in the Pacific with different histories and different cultures. So how do you marry these theories into a system of international law that transcends just the one-offs of Tokyo and Nuremberg, or perhaps the two-offs?
It's very much a Frankenstein kind of system, in the sense that Nuremberg applies the criminal procedure that was followed at Nuremberg is very much a ad hoc combination of statutory law as well as common law. In the years since Nuremberg, the general tradition has been almost to take what happened there, the decisions of the court, the reasoning of the court, as a common law framework. So cases, for example, that come out of the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia or Rwanda or Sierra Leone or Cambodia, for that matter, the decisions of the judges refer back to the interpretation that was given in 1946 when the Nuremberg cases were decided. Mm-hmm. As grounds for their reasoning. That becomes the bedrock, and then you can shift left or you can shift right, but you still have to come back to Nuremberg, and we still do even to right now.
So why, I think the a question that might be at the heart of it is, like, so why not just apply German law to German war criminals? Why do the Americans and the Brits, and to a lesser extent the Soviets, wish to apply some Frankenstein law system rather than take something that already exists, and there are laws on the books against murder, why don't they simply apply those?
In the case of Germany, what they discovered is that if you had applied German law in 1945, most of the acts that are punished as crimes against humanity and war crimes would not have been illegal under German law, mm-hmm. or French law, or Italian law, or Soviet law, for that matter. Mm-hmm. Because of the novel nature of the span of criminal acts committed by Nazi Germany or Imperial Japan, the idea was that we have now, we sort of reached a precipice, and if we don't find a way to make a bridge, our existing legal systems can't handle the enormity of the crimes that these people have committed.
Okay. So how does the world, but specifically, how does kind of the legal community see Nuremberg in Tokyo in the kind of the immediate after effect? Are they seen as successes? Are they seen as new precedents? Or does that take time to develop?
Everyone, I think, there's general agreement that you have reached something new. Nuremberg has, there are some valid criticisms to be made of some of the procedural and legal decisions that are made in Nuremberg. The idea that a country A is putting country B on trial without applying the same standard to itself. Mm-hmm. One of the defenses at Nuremberg, for example, is the idea that can the Americans or British, for example, charge Germany with unrestricted submarine warfare when the U.S. practiced exactly the same thing in the Pacific?
Mm-hmm. And bombing of Germany and Japan.
Well, and it's one of the reasons, too, that in none of the indictments were the German charged with using strategic bombing to attack civilians, of course, because of the Anglo-American bombing offensive.
Right.
There has only been one case anywhere that I know of where anybody was charged with that. It was a Luftwaffe colonel general named Alexander Luhr, who was charged in Yugoslavia for strategic bombing of Belgrade. Hmm. But that case is an isolate. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody ever followed up on that.
Yeah. So what you're touching on is one of the big problems of building an international law system. And to put our listeners in time and place, Henry Kissinger just died, and there's lots of think pieces about, you know, war criminal, savvy diplomat, and we're not talking specifically about Kissinger. But the question this raises is, how do you create an international law system that punishes countries, first problem, instead of individuals? And two, how do you create a system that's fair and equitable when every country has engaged in some kind of at least borderline criminal behavior at some point in its history?
Well, the principle of international law is you do not punish countries. You only punish individuals. And that's been true since Nuremberg. Mm-hmm. The German state is not on trial. The actors using the cover of the German state are on trial. You don't put Yugoslavia on trial. If you want to have a country versus country dispute, you can go to the International Court of Justice, in which case that states are parties. But that's not a criminal mm-hmm. proceeding. So that was never, I think we recognize the danger if state A is trying to put state B on trial, the insurmountable problems that you would have trying to, I think, successfully do that. And one of the other issues, too, is Nuremberg. The framers of Nuremberg and the participants in Nuremberg are well aware of the idea of legitimacy. So if Nuremberg is seen as a kangaroo court, it has none. Mm-hmm. If Tokyo is seen as a kangaroo court, it has none, although there were the Mashta or Homa trials that are separate from mm-hmm. The International Military Tribunal for the Far East. Those are more kangaroo court-ish, but they were outside the scope of the IMT.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So how do you deal with this problem of hypocrisy then, perceived or real? So the example that we used is the Allied powers committed their own dubious acts, we'll call them. The Soviets committed outright war crimes. The rest of the Allied powers committed acts like the bombings of Dresden and Hamburg that might be considered to be war crimes, and yet they were never subject to even real questioning about that. So how in international law do you build a system that is truly equitable given those realities?
I don't know that you can, but I think there's some idea of there are certain advantages that come to winning the war. For example, you don't have defendants inside a dock unless you win the conflict, for the most part. Mm-hmm. That's one of the issues that it, right now when Ukraine is trying to decide how they want to punish Soviet atrocities committed on their territory. Mm-hmm. If they don't have significant Russian, I'm ancient, so I keep confusing Russia and the Soviet Union. but if they don't have Russians, significant Russians in custody, you cannot really have a meaningful war crimes trial that I think both gets the world's attention and also conveys the idea of legitimacy.
Mm-hmm. So let's take that just a step further. So we have Nuremberg.
Right.
Lasts for about, what did we say, about a year. So after Nuremberg, does this precipitate a new era of international law and international courts, or is it seen as a one-off?
You have Nuremberg, the IMT, and then again you have the NMT proceedings that go to 1949. After 49, there is nothing whatsoever. There are international treaties that are entered into. The Genocide Convention is the most prominent of these. But there's no criminal sanctions inside the Genocide Convention. All you're doing is putting your nation's goodwill on the line and saying we reject the idea of genocide. We admit that there's an obligation to do something about it if you determine that it's happening. But it doesn't set up a system of courts. There's no place to punish it. So we go from essentially 1949 through 1998 before we see the next international forum where crimes like those punished at Nuremberg can be adjudicated.
So one of the major issues that we talked about with Dr. Schneider is there's no credible kind of world government body that can adjudicate a lot of these issues before 1945. But of course in 1945 we have the UN Charter, and that's going to spawn a whole series of regional and you know, transnational organizations and treaties and other things. So there's, at least on the surface, there appears to be a paradox. We now, for the first time in human history, have something that could function as a world government, at least in terms of justice. And yet, as you've said, it doesn't produce that during the era of the Cold War. So why do you think that is?
It's funny, because like if you look at the two different paths that were taken starting in the 1990s for international justice, and one of them is a series of tribunals convened by the United Nations. So the International Criminal Tribunal for former Yugoslavia, International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, and there are others. Those functioned, but they are also, because they're created by the United Nations, they're subject to being neutered by parties on the Security Council. Mm-hmm. Alternatively, with the ICC, okay, so the Rome Statute was signed in 1998, comes into effect in 2002. It is separate from the interference from the Security Council and the United Nations. But it is also restricted only to parties who have signed and ratified the convention. The exception, though, recently is Ukraine has granted ICC jurisdiction going back to 2013. So even though they had not previously been a signatory, and mm-hmm. Russia again had been a signatory but withdrew the case, the ICC can prosecute cases against Russia under the ICC framework.
So let's take a couple of these cases. You talk about Rwanda, Yugoslavia, yeah. And another one that comes to mind is, of course, Cambodia.
Yeah.
Any number of atrocities that we can draw on from the second half of the 20th century. So, but of course, in all those conflicts, we don't have the luxury that we had in Nuremberg, where we have a couple army groups sitting on the territory, and we have most of the defendants in hand in jail cells. So how do these international criminal courts handle Cambodia, Rwanda, Yugoslavia
It's so difficult because, for example, I'll give you two cases. So in the case of Cambodia, local sensitivities and preferences took center stage. The rules in Cambodia allowed anyone who had an interest in the case, for example, to question a witness. Now go ahead and let that nightmare scenario play out. It is abhorrent and frightening to anybody who does law for a living that would occur, but it did. In the case of Rwanda, you have the ICTR, but then you have a series of, because there are so many defendants, there were so many Hutus that were guilty of committing mass atrocities. At the very upper level, you have members of the government, you have members of the media, you have some other people, but then you have the people who are actually on the ground doing the killing, thousands of them. So those are punished by tribal courts, and those sentences are determined by those people. In some cases, it means there were a couple of executions, but for the most part, it means either detention for a period of time or some kind of reintegration with the killers now still living in the same place as the surviving victims.
So flash to bang. So for instance, crime is committed.
Right.
To person is brought up on charges to conviction.
So in this case, easy ones, Rwanda, early 90s, Yugoslav wars, most of the 90s. So when do we start seeing those prosecutions and convictions?
2000s. The Cambodia court shut down a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. Yugoslavia ran similarly to only not too many years back. So proceedings that in their entirety take 20 years, or at least the court is functioning for 20 years. And we've spoken of this like in sort of the pre-interview before today's podcast. The case of Cambodia, 16 years, say, worth of proceedings, a boatload of money, mm-hmm. and they convict three people. Mm-hmm. So if your outcome is satisfactory international justice or protection for people who may be the victims of war crimes or crimes against humanity, 16 years and three convictions doesn't really, you know, get the job done.
So let's talk about some of the kind of the basic elements of this. And one of them has to do with how this compares to a traditional, let's say, a murder trial.
Right.
So if somebody shoots somebody else on the street, what's the normal time from committing of crime to trial to sentence, assuming they're found guilty?
It's going to vary, but I think universally this would be within a calendar year that you would go from offense to conviction and then hopefully sustain on appeal.
And so then, in at least in the United States, the appeal is often while the convicted person is in prison.
Yeah.
So it's not like they're out. Why is it so different with these international tribunals?
There are many stakeholders, and I think that's part and parcel of this idea of international justice. And even at Nuremberg, there were some fracture lines, more or less closely associated with national groups. So in the case of Nuremberg, the Soviet position was to convict all of the defendants and essentially use Nuremberg as an extension of the Soviet show trials from the 1930s. Mm-hmm. The American position is a little more nuanced. The British position is a little more nuanced. And the French position, but again, serving French national interests, they want certain defendants convicted and other defendants that they don't have as much interest in.
Mm-hmm. So looking at Rwanda, Cambodia, mm-hmm. so we talked about kind of Nuremberg is just basically they're almost making it up as they go along, drawing upon kind of some common ideas. So before the Rome Conventions, did I get that right? Rome
yeah.
Conventions?
Rome Statute.
Before the Rome Statute, what legal foundations are they using? And then is there a law written, or are they kind of making it up? And also then how do you then adjudicate sentences?
It's the same thing, too, that we talked about with Nuremberg. So in the case of the ICC, you're using precedents both from Nuremberg as well as from ICTR and ICTY. So they're going back into decisions made by other judges, even though you're not in the same system. So the ICC is separate from the ad hoc or the other tribunals, but the reasoning that the judges use is based on their understanding of what those decisions said and how they can draw an analogy between those situations and the one you have in front of you. In the case of Rwanda, you have one of the sub-cases is called the media case. You're prosecuting people who not only encouraged people to kill Tutsis, but they actually directed the killers to the places where they could kill, and they coordinated and organized. So in that instance, for looking back on instances where you're talking about incitement, there are some precedents coming out of both Nuremberg as well as the International Tribunal plus the Nuremberg Military Tribunal, where they're going back and looking to establish a line of reason.
So these international courts are basically improvising based upon what other people have improvised to do in a way.
Well, I think improvising is probably not the right word. So okay. you're reasoning by legal analogy. It isn't that you're not making. Hopefully you're not. that's another discussion for another day. But where you have there's like these idiosyncratic rulings that come that reject the principle of the common law, or sort of this continuous idea of judicial reasoning. But they at least try. And some of the sentences and some of the judges on an ICC panel, which come from all over, who come from all over, you get some strange thinking sometimes that goes on there.
So let's talk about, some of the kind of basic level details and ask maybe perhaps some more dumb legal questions. So we talked about earlier kind of the garden variety street murder. Right, somebody shoots somebody else. The person shot dies. The perpetrator is put on trial and convicted. So, what's the difference between that happening on a street in a city, say in America, and an American soldier doing that in a war zone, not to an enemy combatant, but to an enemy civilian? What's kind of the legal difference?
The law would be different because obviously in the case of the military, you would rely on military jurisprudence, but for example, the United States also has a war crime statute that we've never used it yet, which would allow punishment of not just military people who commit war crimes. And the military has certainly laws, but the military also does not. Under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, there is no subsection for war crimes. That's not a concept that exists there.
Mm-hmm. So, and to get at that term war crimes, I think a lot of times people kind of snap to World War II and the Holocaust.
Understandably, yeah.
Right, it's certainly understandable. Or perhaps we mentioned Cambodia as well. So when we think of war crimes, I don't think we tend to think of crimes that happen in war. I think we're thinking in terms of scale. So it's relatively easy to prosecute the murder of a civilian in a war zone, provided all of the normal things that make prosecution possible, witnesses, forensics, all of that. How is it different to prosecute somebody who's a government agent, or even a head of government, like Slobodan Milosevic in Yugoslavia, for war crimes that are done at scale and are not necessarily directly practiced by the perpetrator? So you mentioned the Rwandan radio hosts who are inciting genocide, the Nazi newspapermen who are inciting genocide. So what's the difference between the street level murder and the kind of constructed mass murder or mass campaign of a genocide?
I like the question. So in most cases, for example, if soldier A kills civilian B, I'm going to prosecute that under the Uniform Code of Military Justice for murder. Mm-hmm. There's no war crimes. I don't need a war crimes framework to do that. It's just straight up law. Person A kills person B. That's a crime anywhere in the world that happens. Mm-hmm. The other part thing is, too, that we've made war crimes into sort of a generic term that is different than the way the Nuremberg Tribunal understood it. The Nuremberg Tribunal understood it as one count of four. whereas now we conflate the term to encompass things that, for example, a genocide or a war crime or a crime against, you know, the rest of it. Mm-hmm. To rise to the level of war crimes, generally speaking, there has to be some sort of overarching state from the defendants, a state framework, a state organization, state direction, evidence of using state resources to effect a murders, on a significant scale. The difficulty, too, is when you start getting into the verbiage of it. So, for example, there's a common understanding of what genocide is, and then there's the actual wording of the crime. Mm-hmm. For example, genocide defines, the word genocide is defined as the killing or intent to kill in whole or in part a group for a wide variety of reasons. It could be racial reasons, it could be ethnic, it could be and so forth. How many people it takes to make that? Can you kill one person even though you have the intent to kill all of them? Mm-hmm. Technically, that would constitute a genocide. Mm-hmm. But that's an absurd result. You're not going to put a person on trial for genocide for killing a person. Mm-hmm. It's left up to the tribunal or the trier of fact to decide, okay, this does in fact meet a reasonable standard of this is what genocide looks like.
Mm-hmm. So following on from that, you have been a prosecutor. Mm-hmm. So you have dealt with some of these issues, at least in perhaps microcosm.
Yeah, yeah, oh, definitely. I'm not. Yeah, this is not like Mark Hall, genocide prosecutor.
Right,
of the
right.
Stars.
I don't think you were Nuremberg.
No.
So if you get the case of, you know, the standard kind of thing that happens in every war, a soldier kills, robs from, rapes someone, mm-hmm. versus you get a report of a soldier who has fired into a crowd and killed 20 people and wounded 50 more.
Right.
Is there a difference for you as the prosecutor in how you might approach those?
No, in that you would have multiple counts. If you kill one person, you have a count of murder. If you kill 20 persons, you have 20 counts of murder. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, again, it's going to bump it up. Issues of command responsibility come in, for example, that are often involved in war crimes prosecutions. Mm-hmm. If I can show that this is not a one-off, if I can show that this is a pattern for this unit or for this corps or this army or this country, for that matter, I think that's it more properly belongs in one forum rather than the other. That is something that should be dealt with by the ICC, but then again, you get into the complication of the fact that there are many countries that simply are not within their jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm. So taking that example and kind of expanding it a little bit more, not just to, you know, okay, soldiers are shooting in there, but maybe to kind of build off that example you sort of mentioned, which is command responsibility. What happens if you have the report that comes up of, it's not just, hey, we have individual cases here, but now we have a systemic policy.
Meli.
A systemic example of, this is occurring not just as a couple of individual bad actors, but you actually have, this is the government doing it. I can't think of the Soviets going through East Prussia in World War II. I'm thinking World War II, where it was basically a policy of revenge.
Mm-hmm. Or American free fire zones in Vietnam.
How does that suddenly shift the prosecution?
So let's go back to My Lai for a second. So you have killings of approximately 500 civilians in two villages by Bravo and Charlie Company. Task Force Barker, 11th Brigade AmeriCal Division. So the idea is that even up to the general officer level, the two-star, it was General Koster. What did General Koster know? Did he understand that his troops were committing mass murders? Were they directed to commit mass murders? It was another issue of both the Cali case and Medina. And some of the other people who were indicted but never actually saw a trial. the further you get up the food chain, the greater the likelihood, again, in the case of Mealy, it never went anywhere for a variety of reasons, mostly political reasons. It never went anywhere. You're getting out of the competence of the military judiciary to probably handle those sorts of cases. I mean, a court-martial is not the proper venue if you can prove that there is a directive from a senior political official to commit an act of murder. That's not the right venue for that. But the problem is then, what would be the right venue? If it's 1968 or 1969, there is no real proper venue. We don't have, there is no place, even if you ceded jurisdiction to a federal court, that is not something that they've ever done. But there is, at that point, no international venue where you can prosecute things like that. So unfortunately, we have millions of victims killed all over the planet for whom there's never going to be any justice, because there, at the time, or even maybe now, there's no place for you to go to ask for justice.
So let's take this kind of a step further as we're kind of looking at it, right? So we're talking, the kind of examples we use was an American system with an American, and as you highlighted, there comes a point where the system starts to lose control a little bit, depending on how high up the problem goes.
Often directly varying with the scale of the
crime. Right, but what we see is we still see that there is an American system that could work, if not well. Let's take a system where we're looking at a country like, say, Rwanda or the former Yugoslavia as an example, where we, the United States, are looking at it, and you might even have one of the combatants saying, hey, these bad things are happening. How does the United States, or how does the international community, then actually do something about it? To then actually declare it's a war crime. Yep. And then do something and then go to the next step.
Well, in the case of like the ICC, the prosecutor's office would receive information and then they would conduct an investigation, and then the prosecutor's office is the initiating body that would get something to the ICC. One of the other issues too, and I can't stress how either mostly tragic this is the idea that if you go to the ICC or you go to the ICTY or ICTR, in almost every case, you're prosecuting the order givers, not the order carrier-outers. So the people that are actually on the ground and doing the murders, that are committing the atrocities, that are committing every malignant thing that human beings are capable of doing, those people are probably never going to be put on trial. In Mealy, you have two full companies of infantry. That's a lot of people, and they didn't see even a blemish on their service record for mutilating and raping and murdering close to 500 people. I don't know what to say about that, except that the military system is resourced based on anticipated levels of criminality. We're not used to, we don't have any place to put two full companies of infantry into court martial system right now. In the case of World War II, you've got more than a million general courts, special courts, and that occurred during the time of the war. But again, the focus is in most cases put on the people that you think are in supervisory responsibility or have given an order rather than being a perpetrator.
And let's take this a step further. So we have the very, very significant structural issues that we have to overcome. The other piece is, what happens when I am, Yugoslavia, it's a war zone. How do I investigate, one, how do I investigate in a war zone? And two, how am I going to properly conduct interviews or interrogate people that are not only have guns themselves, but are surrounded by people with guns and may feel no particular compunction to answer to somebody from the Netherlands or The Hague.
it goes back to what I said before. You have to win the war.
Yeah.
But I've got a friend I was talking to a few months ago, and he was one of the prosecutors in the Yugoslavia cases. So this is after the war's over, and he's going down to Kosovo to do sort of they're digging up bodies and they're gathering witness statements, And if the wrong person talks to the authorities, they just suddenly die sometimes, or they're just flat out killed. So even winning the war isn't a guarantee that you're going to get people able to come forward, that their testimony is competent witness testimony, that it can be corroborated. Those are things that are true both in if somebody commits a murder in Leavenworth as well as if somebody commits a murder in Yugoslavia.
And, of course, winning a war is a very subjective term because sure. World War II, as we started off with, multiple Allied and Soviet Army groups planted on German soil. Germany really, as a state, functionally does not exist.
We took away their sovereignty. Right?
Whereas in the former Yugoslavia, the war was perhaps over, but we didn't have American forces crawling over all parts of it. We had some forces in Bosnia, but we didn't have. But American forces did not have the ability to be everywhere in Serbia, and we certainly did not have the authority to just go everywhere we would like to be.
And the same thing too, like even in Iraq. Okay, by some measure, the war in Iraq is over, or perhaps not. But the idea of going back to now to investigate war crimes committed by Shiite militias in Iraq, good luck with that. First of all, there's no appetite to do it. Secondly, there's no witness that would be able to stay in the country and give testimony without themselves or their families being killed. And the government actively doesn't want that to happen. So you can have the best intentions in the world, and you can have the law on your side, but there is every likelihood that a prosecution will collapse, or at least is going to be like a wet sponge because of the other factors involved. We take that for granted here in the United States, some places not, that people are able or willing to come forward, and they're not going to get killed for doing it. Mm-hmm. That isn't true. First of all, it's not true in some places in the U.S., but it's certainly not true in other places around the world. It's great you have the ICC, but the impediments to getting justice from the ICC are many. But I don't know what the alternative is.
Well, let's talk about a current example from the Russia-Ukraine war. One of the things that has been of particular consternation to the legal community is the, I don't know how we want to phrase it, the kidnapping, the removal of Ukrainian children to Russia, which is explicitly a war crime,
right,
if I'm correct. And I believe at least two Russian leaders have been indicted for that. Vladimir Putin, the president,
and Sergei Lavrov.
And I believe there's also a minister for children in Russia who's been indicted for it, or some cabinet official. So there is an indictment. There is a war going on. What does that indictment mean for what's going on now versus what might happen, as you said, kind of the meantime 15 years later?
The answer is going to depend on the forum. So, for example, in the ICC, you are not allowed to try people in absentia. Mm-hmm. In Nuremberg, Martin Bormann was one of the defendants. He had a lawyer. He was put on trial. Even though he was missing, it turns out he'd been dead since May 1945, but mm-hmm. they didn't find that out until much later.
Yeah.
So that's not possible. Unless you have somebody in custody, you can't put them on trial. The likelihood, and this is, you know, a group that I work with of prosecutors and Ukrainian prosecutors and judges, kicking over the idea that the likelihood of getting a Russian Federation State Minister or Lavrov or Vladimir Putin into a dock is minimal, unless there is some catastrophic, you know, upheaval in Russia,
mm-hmm.
Maybe not even then. Yeah, if they live long enough.
Yeah, because neither of those two men is young, so.
So what then do you do? You either put low-level Sergeant, you know, Popov on trial for something, or you have a lot of places with cardboard cutouts and a Ukrainian state prosecution.
Mm-hmm.
and that doesn't really satisfy Ukraine. It doesn't help with their national narrative. It doesn't
return the
joy. It doesn't assuage the pain that the victims feel. It doesn't do any of the things that we always hope that trials do. Mm-hmm. So right now they're kind of in a quandary. I think they want to do the right thing, but the circumstances have to be on their side to allow them to do the right thing.
So let's talk about this idea of legitimacy that we talked about earlier, because I think it's central to what we're discussing here. There's a question of sovereignty, that countries ultimately have sovereignty, even over international organizations, and countries that become subject to international organizations, like the ICC, often protest their sovereignty as being infringed. But there's another layer of legitimacy, I think, that's interesting to discuss as well. If we return to Nuremberg and we think about the people who were on trial there, the Hermann Görings, the people who were not, as you say, kind of the Sergeant Friedrich. These are the people who knew about the Holocaust and who did it on purpose, willingly. What's the purpose of putting them on trial? Why not just take Hermann Göring out in the middle of a plot and shoot him in the head? Which I don't know that too many people would have objected to in 1945.
Well, and the British were fans of that idea. So picking, say, 50 Germans, mm-hmm. And leaders and just shooting them. But Nuremberg is, the motives for Nuremberg are many. One of them is to, is objectively justice. Okay, here is a punishment that you get for the thing that you did. The other thing with Nuremberg is it allows the German leaders and the survivors of the senior members of the Nazi system to be put on trial, which in some ways is kind of a pass for the rest of the population, because it allows them to say, well, those are the people that are responsible. They misled, they directed, they ordered, they terrorized the rest of the population. And it also allows a clean break with the past, so that the German government that comes in 1949 can look back at Nuremberg and the trial after Nuremberg and then denazification procedures and say, okay, we're kind of starting with a clean slate now. Mm-hmm. We have done everything that we could do. That isn't necessarily true at all, but it's a step. And that West Germany is now ready to rejoin the Community of Nations in 1949 and then get their army back in 1955. Mm-hmm. So, and then their national interests. Okay, the Soviets have an agenda. They want to make sure, for example, that the Germans get blamed for the Katyn massacre, and they want to make sure that nobody ever, ever, ever mentions the fact that the Soviets invaded Poland or the Baltic States or the rest of it.
They were invited in, of course.
Yeah, and the French want justification for seizing land in Germany and factories and the Saar and the Rhineland. So there's this weird, like when I teach the class, if I do a Nuremberg class or I do the war crimes class, I give everybody a sheet. Okay, here your country, France, here are some six things that are true, and now you get to negotiate and see what you think the rules could be. Mm-hmm. And there, some cases, they're diametrically opposed to each other. Mm-hmm. So when the Soviets try to introduce testimony that proves that the Germans killed, 21,000 Polish officers, the Western response is to be polite, and then it never, ever, ever gets mentioned in the judgment again, because they know that they're lying. Mm-hmm. But they're your allies at the moment, so you have to sort of tolerate a certain degree of like weirdness or misbehavior or bad faith, because at the moment you want to keep the alliance together. But by the time Nuremberg's over in 46, it's apparent, okay, there's nothing that's going to keep this alliance together, which is why there's not a second Nuremberg. Even though there had been plans for one, mm-hmm. It's apparent that nobody has any interest in doing that, except the Russians.
So let's take this to the Russia-Ukraine example. Let's speculate wildly. Let's say there's a revolution in Russia. Putin is overthrown. He's not killed, but he's captured. The government of Alexei Navalny turns him over to Ukraine. What's the ideal scenario there? And what do you think would be likely to happen? And is there any difference between the two?
I don't think it can be only... I think you take what you get, or what you can get. So I think if you have only Vladimir Putin, you put him on trial. But I think you're going to have a corpus of other Soviet leaders that you can show by direct evidence, and the whole evidentiary piece is another discussion for a much maybe a many other different days. Mm-hmm. In terms of reliability of evidence, or can you introduce evidence without revealing sources and methods? Mm-hmm. Even if you're, for example, one of my favorite post Nuremberg proceedings was the Einsatzgruppen trial. So you're putting 22 Germans on trial for killing a million people, mm-hmm. by shooting and by gas van. And it's the first time in history that the prosecution never called a single witness, mm-hmm. except people to testify to the authenticity of the captured German documents and to the translation. Because mm-hmm. you didn't need human beings to testify. First of all, there weren't any because they were dead. Mm-hmm. But the effectiveness of a documents-only prosecution, the thing is, that doesn't have very much high drama. So I don't, in some ways, that does not serve the best interest of the narrative your country wants to tell. I think if your only defendant is Vladimir Putin, or you can only present documents as testimony, or intercepts, or forensics, I don't think it's satisfactory.
So we're back to the question of why not just shoot him in the head in the town square?
I suspect if you polled people in living in the places where the atrocities had happened, I don't think many people would object to that. Mm-hmm. But in terms of what the world community expects, or what we think that international justice expects, we feel the obligation to go through a formal trial to maybe, possibly, could be... deter this from happening, but I don't think that's likely.
So the question then might become, which is, if the only, because whereas a revolution in Russia is possible, it may not be probable. In fact, anybody that guesses how Russia-Ukraine turns out is anybody's guess, right?
Yeah.
But in what we can probably guess is that it'll come down to some sort of negotiated settlement in the best case scenario, because worst case scenarios involve nukes, I think. But let's take that negotiated settlement. So Putin is not going to surrender himself to the ICC. And at that, and if we can really only establish international justice when the international community, whatever that might look like, is in physical possession of the ground, which is fairly rare, is there a value in having a standing court for it?
I do, again, I think, serving some of the other interests that Ukraine has. I think that they need the world to understand, okay, that they are the victims of Russian aggression. And other than making a putting out a tweet or a TikTok about it, I think you need something where it draws the world's attention. It has to be fairly short because, again, there's a shelf life on criminal procedures. People stop paying attention to Cambodia and Rwanda because or Yugoslavia because you can't keep your attention on the ball for 20 years, or for a year is probably stretching it. Mm-hmm. At the outer limits. So the proceeding has to be efficient and short and dramatic, and the narrative has to be the correct one. But I think if you can satisfy all those things, Ukraine has an interest in making sure that happens.
So what you're saying is that as a civilized society, there are certain things we expect.
Yeah.
So this is a topic for its own podcast, but I would like to touch on it, and that's the dark side of international law, what is sometimes referred to as lawfare, where a country like Russia will flagrantly violate international norms and laws. They'll invade their neighbors, they'll conduct cyber attacks against them, they'll kidnap their children. And when Ukraine sends a drone to bomb a bridge in Russia, Russia will accuse them of violating international law.
Sure.
So there are bad actors who are cynically using international law and traditions and customs purely for their own interests. How does that figure into this whole process?
Well, it's the span of history. So even in World War II, Propaganda Minister Joseph Goebbels was quick off the mark time and time and time again of accusing the Western allies of being barbaric, flagrant violators of customary international law. And some of the time he was right, but the point is, it's something that the Germans felt necessary to for the narrative of for their own people, that you not only have to portray the enemy as being aggressive, you have to provide the narrative that they're violating the norms and customs of civilization. And they're lies. And I think Russia's under the same thing, too. They're part of the modern 21st century. They cannot help but make the argument that the Ukrainians are being, that the Ukrainians are war criminals. It's not us. This is a defensive war. It is a war that is forced upon us. It is a war fought for the survival of ethnic Russians inside Ukrainian territory. And we've heard all this before from the 1930s, 1940s. Mm-hmm. But the narrative sort of worked in the 1930s and 40s, and it kind of sort of works if you're a member of the Russian Federation in 2023. Mm-hmm.
So this is all very high-minded. It's good history. It's fascinating history. It's, as we said, it's a part of military history that's often not discussed enough. What does this matter to the average soldier, NCO, junior officer today, or in the near future of what we call multi-domain operations?
You talking in terms of like the American army?
Let's go with American. I hope that works.
I don't know. I think you could use, and I hope we do, use current events more to reinforce our notion of the law of armed conflict, that it matters, and it matters from in a whole host of areas. It matters just from a moral perspective. It matters of being, you know, if you like, and I don't mean this in an ecclesiastical way, but like good and evil, but right and wrong, and law and not law, and the idea that if you want to carry the banner that you're protecting people, you actually need to do it. And upholding the law is I think one measure of that. It's not the only one. Sometimes it's not the best one, but it's the one that we have. So any chance we get to have those conversations with our privates and sergeants and lieutenants and generals, let me say this again, generals, where they are responsible for maintaining order and discipline and maintaining some sort of a moral compass, I hope we don't ever stop talking about it.
So, final question. Given the realities of international law and international law systems, given the successes of some of the, particularly the Yugoslav trials, given the perceived impotence currently of international law in the Russia-Ukraine conflict, what do you, Dr. Hull, think the future of international law is?
I don't know the answer to that. So I was talking with young Colonel Nance here before the podcast started, that there is a relationship between the likelihood of being caught and deterrence. Some of the people that I respect most that have been idols to me within the international legal community cling to the idea that international law can somehow come to save us, that it can deter future occurrences of genocide and war crimes and crimes against humanity generally. I don't know that I completely believe that, but I hope it is true. But if there is no likelihood of being caught, there is zero deterrence value. If I'm only putting X number of people on trial, which means that 99.9% of the people are never, ever going to face a consequence of it, it's not deterrence. And I don't know how to at scale, make sure that the structures exist for more people to answer for their crimes. I wish I did, and I don't know how we do that.
All right, fair enough. This has been an interesting and important discussion. Dr. Hull, thank you.
Thank you. This was fun.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.